It's a real pleasure to be here. Let me just begin by trying to put a little bit of perspective on how I want to approach these issues. And that is to see issues of global finance, global architecture, financial architecture, as a means to an end, not an end in itself. And we sometimes forget this confusion between ends and means. I've been very critical of the Washington Consensus as often for confusing ends and means. Two examples of that discussed in two of the books that the Initiative for Policy Dialogue has put out recently. One that was co-authored between Jose Antonio Ocampo and myself is called Stability with Growth. And it argues that the kinds of stabilization policies that the IMF has pursued, focusing on price stability, have actually not resulted in real stability, and we ought to be focusing on real stability, but in fact have not only not accomplished real stability, have actually in doing that compromised long-term economic growth. And those are the things we ought to be focusing on, real stability and real growth. And the other one is a book called Fair Trade for All. I'm going to be focusing on financial issues, but because trade is such a big issue and during the question period, we can talk about that. What it tries to argue is the so-called development round of trade negotiations doesn't deserve that name. It was an attempt to put old wine in new bottles, and it's totally different from what if you would put development economists from around the world and said what would be a trade regime that would promote economic development. It would be totally different from what has been on the agenda and what is likely to emerge, if anything emerges, from the current set of negotiations. So again, it's not trade globalization as an end in itself, but trade globalization as an instrument for long-term economic growth, and that the current proposals do not accomplish that. Well, we are celebrating this year, if I can use that word, the 10th anniversary of the East Asian crisis. It is hard now to remember what things were like 10 years ago. The crisis began on July 2nd, 1997, with the Thai baht collapsing through the floor, and spread in October to Indonesia, and then December to Korea, and embraced most of the countries. And when markets are declining, exchange rates are declining, economy is going into recession, you don't know where the bottom is. And it is exactly that that causes problems. If you knew that there, you know that there is eventually going to be a bottom, but you don't know how far you're going to drop before you reach that, and that is a major source of anxiety. The East Asian crisis eventually spread and became the global financial crisis of 1998, and summer and fall of 1998, concerns got so great that the Fed, which almost never responds to global financial, always focuses on things domestically, inflation and growth in the United States, actually cut the interest rates in an attempt to, it thought, avert a global financial crisis. So one has to, as we think about what happened then, where we are today, one has to try to put oneself back in the mood of 10 years ago and realize the state of anxiety that prevailed then, I think deservedly so, because it wasn't clear how bad things were getting. And for the people in many of the countries, they did get very bad. Estimates are that in the island of Java, for instance, eventually unemployment rates got up to 40%. In these countries, these events were as big as the Great Depression, which has left such a telling effect in the United States and UK. As we look back on that, it's also useful to remember both the kinds of policies that were put forward, the models that were underlying those policies, and several of the very strongly held views that were described as consensus views, consensus mainly between the U.S. Treasury and the IMF, and consensus that's easy to achieve when you're the boss of one institution. So that is to say, U.S. Treasury was giving orders to the IMF. So the consensus may be a little bit artificial. Among the views that were put forward then, for instance, were the two vote poll views of exchange rates. Either you ought to have perfectly flexible exchange rates, or you should have perfectly rigid exchange rates. And for those of you who are young enough not to have gone through that discussion, you say, that's absurd. And what was interesting is almost at the same time of this, the Ford Foundation convened an eminent persons group, which came to the consensus among a group of eminent economists, mainly from the developing countries, but people with a long experience in this, that the correct problem was neither of these two poles put something in the center. The IMF abandoned one of those two poles after the Argentine crisis. The second proposition that was very widely held at the time was that capital market liberalization was unambiguously a good thing. In fact, at the meeting 10 years ago, not now, but 10 years ago in September, the annual meeting, they tried to change their charter to force countries to liberalize their capital markets. I was had just come to the World Bank. Perhaps I had too recent experience of being in academia. So I asked the question, where is the evidence that this is good for economic growth? And as it was a little bit naive, the response was, we don't need evidence. We know the truth. And how do we know it? Because everybody we talk to says the same thing. And, of course, if you only talk to people who agree with you, you will get a consensus among that small group. So there wasn't any evidence. I mean, really remarkable. They tried to change the charter, the architecture of the global economy without any evidence that it was good for growth of the developing countries. The World Bank had actually, by that point, already amassed plenty of evidence that it was bad for stability. Capital comes in, capital comes out, and we were about to get a massive more evidence on capital market liberalization because the East Asia crisis, I think now most people realize at least one of the most important contributing factors were these massive flows of speculative capital money coming in and out of countries. Well, the third pillar, the third, you know, the strategies of the IMF at the time were very much raise interest rates, cut back expenditures, raise taxes. In other words, contractionary fiscal monetary policies in response to an economic downturn. Just the opposite of what is taught in virtually every course, undergraduate and graduate course around the world. And again, I mean, it was really quite startling, and I was startled coming from academia that these countries were being told to do the opposite of what, as I say, everybody is taught in graduate school and undergraduate. Well, as I've said many times, the good news was that we didn't have to revise our textbooks. The standard wisdom turned out to be right. These countries, contractionary monitoring fiscal policies did have the predicted effects of depressing their economies. The downturns turned into recessions and depressions. There was an attempt by the U.S. Treasury to even suppress the use of what they called the D and R words. They said, you know, it would be depressing if we mentioned depressions. So they told us not to use that. Those words, GDP going down 12 or 15%, we'll call it a market correction. I think there are some major changes that have happened since then, but in the midst of that crisis, there was a call for a change in global governance and a change in the global financial architecture, and neither of these have happened. And I think the wisdom at the time was, If they didn't happen in the moment of crisis, they would not happen after the crisis. And I think that was right. But in fact, those who were controlling the processes didn't want them to happen. And so what they did is they put together a number of palliatives to sort of give the impression of something happening, but nothing really happening, no real fundamental changes. One of the things that positive things that did happen was that the IMF eventually began to do research on the question of what were the effects of capital market liberalization. A little late, but better late than never. And finally, in 2003, they came out with a report, and chief economists and a number of his colleagues came out with a report, and it came to the only conclusion that it could have, which was that capital market liberalization does not have positive effects on growth and has negative effects on stability, at least in many countries. It doesn't have in other words, it didn't have the effects that they had asserted. They were surprised, and this itself tells a great deal about the mindset. They were surprised because they said it was inconsistent with economic theory. And what that is useful for is reminding us, all of us have theories in our mind, all of us could walk around with a theoretical structure, otherwise we couldn't see, understand anything. Keynes put it very forcefully. We said a lot of what we think of, you know, practical men are theories of 50 years ago that have eventually come and got embedded in our mind. Unfortunately, sometimes the theories that are embedded in our minds are theories that have since then been discarded. So when they said it was against economic theory, what theory did they have in mind? They had a theory based on people who live infinitely long in a world with perfect information and perfect capital markets. Now, I don't know about you, but I live in worlds where people live a finite length of time. And as I get older, one realizes that more and more. And that people live in a world with imperfect information and imperfect risk markets. So that the underlying assumptions were just fundamentally wrong. And if you have a wrong model, and if you go through life saying this is the world, then you're going to have problems. And that is essentially what happened. You know, theoretical analysis showing that dropping these assumptions, any one of them, even perfect information, but finitely lived individuals, capital market liberalization could lead to more instability. Imperfect information can lead to more instability. And in fact, the interesting thing is, had they come to the result that it was stabilizing, they would have had even a greater challenge, because we know that many times capital flows are pro-cyclical. So how in the world can it be that capital market liberalization leads to stabilization when capital flows are pro-cyclical? So this, I just want to emphasize this is because it does illustrate some of the problems that we have. There are some very strong ideologies, and they are almost religions. They are not challenged by the facts. When the facts come, they say, in 2006 they came out with another paper saying, well, we know capital market liberalization has to be good for growth. We just haven't seen it in the data. And it comes through these other processes, like good governance and things like that, but we still haven't been able to detect it. So what is remarkable is that it has all the indicia of what we would call, you know, a religion, an ideology, that when evidence comes to you that says something's wrong, rather than saying let's revise our understanding of the world, it says let's make sure we can get the world to conform to our beliefs. So the second thing that I think is a major change that has happened is that the IMF has realized that its legitimacy is in question. And that becomes particularly important because one of the main agenda that they talk about now is governance. You thought that they were supposed to be concerned with financial markets. But one of the reasons that they say that growth, that capital market liberalization is supposed to be good for growth and stability is because capital market liberalization now, they say, is important because it leads to good governance. Good governance is the mantra of the day, and everything has to be linked to good governance. And then good governance leads to higher growth and stability. So, but then the response in many countries is, well, if good governance is so important, why don't you have good governance? And that is a question that has been increasingly asked of its sister institution, the World Bank, where issues of, you know, it has put corruption at the center of the agenda. Everybody's against corruption. That's not the issue. The question is there corruption in the corruption agenda? Is there due process? As democracies, we think due process is important. And is there due process of bringing charges of corruption? And most importantly, is there a comprehensive, effective anti-corruption agenda? It's not just a speech. It's not just it depends on things like good procurement processes. And the World Bank has actually very good procurement processes, competitive procurement practices that the Defense Department in the last 6 years, often short-circuited with disastrous results. So the issue of global governance become of legitimacy, political legitimacy in the institution becomes important as it itself focuses on the issues of governance. And the issues there have to do with how the heads of these institutions are chosen, the distribution of voting rights, voice, representation, and so forth. The IMF is, the good side is it's recognized that problem, it's changed the voting rights a little bit, but not in ways that have a fundamental effect on outcomes. Africa, which is the main source of one of the main areas of lending, the major area in which there's poverty, has under 4% of the votes. And that means that in trying to reach a coalition about what good policies are, it's just not worth paying any attention to Africa. Some people say, well, the lenders are providing the money. Shouldn't their voice be larger? But actually, one of the interesting things under the reforms that occurred in the 80s, the real support of the IMF comes not from the lenders, but from the borrowers. The lenders are getting a return on their money. The borrowers are financing the institution through a spread on the money that they borrow. And right now, one of the problems is that people don't want to borrow from the IMF. Usually banks try to be friendly to their customers, and the history here has not been stellar in customer relations. And so it's not as surprising that one country accounts now for over half of the outstanding loans of the IMF, and therefore effectively supporting the IMF. And I teased my friends from that country about, did you really make a decision that you want to keep provide the support for this institution? Well, one of the real problems is the broader problems of global governance is how the international community makes decisions. And there are a variety of institutions, formal and informal, and I think some of the informal institutions do play a very important role, and one of them is the G8. And what should be increasingly clear is that the G8 does not provide an appropriate forum for addressing global issues like global financial issues. The G8, for instance, this year has been talking about global imbalances, but one of the themes is that one of the problems is China. But China is not a member of the G8. So they're saying China is so important that is a major factor in global imbalances, but you can only come to lunch. you can't be a real member of the club. That obviously is one of the things that needs to get reformed. We convened the Initiative Policy Dialogue in conjunction with some German foundations, convened a meeting of what we call the Shadow G8, a group of people from a large number of countries, not limited to eight. We had China, India. We had a large number of countries. We called it the GM. I think in the a table at the back is a summary of our conclusions. We tried to talk about what the G8 should talk about, a little bit what they should conclude after they talk about these issues. And one of the points of consensus was the G8 should be changed to the GN. I think that is, when we think about global imbalances, that is one of the things that ought to be clearly on the agenda. I want to very quickly talk now about the substance of the global imbalances, which you described as being very large. And the question is, should there be a concern? There's one view is, no, you have markets, market equilibrium, demand and supply in any configuration. Some countries are borrowing from others. Economic theory doesn't say what is a reasonable amount of borrowing. So this is just the equilibrium that we're in today. So why worry? It's a market equilibrium. Well, I think there are reasons to worry. And the most obvious reason that one suspects something's peculiar about this is, there are actually several. One of them is that the world, this is a very strange, it's not what you would expect from a reasonable, well-behaved economy. For instance, the United States, looking at it from America's perspective, is borrowing abroad $850 billion. Well, America is going through a process of an aging baby boomers. I'm in the baby boomer generation, and eventually we will retire. And what that means is that this is part of the demographic pattern where we should be saving, not borrowing. And then later on, we should go on and dissave. So we're just doing the opposite. We're in the process of dissaving when we should be saving. Very strange and not consistent with certainly infinitely live utility maximization. Anyway, the second problem, and probably the most what worries most, the second problem has to do with the developing country. You should think that money should be flowing from rich countries to poor countries. And that flow of money should support the growth. The poor countries are where there's capital scarcity. Rich countries are supposed to be capital abundance, and that's the direction. You know, it's just like water should flow downhill. If you saw water flowing uphill, you'd say something's wrong. Anti-gravity. Anyway, the same thing with money now in the world. Something's peculiar. Money is flowing from poor countries to rich countries. And what all of this leads up to is that things will go eventually from being wrong to more right, and that is that there will be a disorderly unwinding of the imbalances. Disorderly unwinding means large changes in asset prices, maybe a crisis, and that will have global implications for the real economy, which is what we're really interested in. So that is the source of concern, and I think it's a legitimate source of concern. And the question is, what is the source of the problem? Now, when the finance ministers get together this week, they will almost surely repeat the standard mantra. The standard mantra is you get together in a meeting and you say, we are all to blame, and we all have to work harder. And the general blame, shared blame, is Europe should grow faster, as if Europe is deliberately not growing as fast as it could. The second one is that China should revalue its exchange rate, up, not down, and usually float, because we going back to the free market hypothesis. And the third is that the U.S. should do something about its deficits. Now, there may be a grain of truth in all three of these, but I think one has to look at this from a system, from a perspective of proportionate blame. And I can't go through a good limit of time, but let me just hint at what I mean by that. China's deficit, China's multilateral surplus is $150 billion, roughly. It's not clear whether that's a accurate number. Many people believe that the true number is substantially less than that because of over-invoicing of exports and under-invoicing of imports. In a world of capital controls, there are strong reasons for engaging in this. But think for a moment, what would happen if China succeeded in getting rid of its surplus and brought it down to zero, and in doing that, dollar for dollar was translated into a reduction in the U.S. multilateral trade deficit. The U.S. trade deficit would go from $850 billion to $700 billion, a huge number, more than $2 billion a day. So the basic point is that correcting China's problem doesn't solve the global imbalance problem. Only one thing will, and that's the United States.
Can I interrupt you right there? This looks like a really good point to jump off to Jose, who has been wrestling with exactly these kinds of issues that you're beginning to raise right here. Why are we concerned? What's the worry here? And your arguments are going to get at that there is no simple solution to this, but you've raised concerns about both a system that is sort of based on one reserve currency and like the US dollar, as well as concerns about a system based on many currencies. You want to jump in and pick up from here?
Yeah, well, can I just say maybe two sentences, and that will, or maybe three sentences. The first is that, in fact, if you think about what would happen if China revalued its exchange rate, it actually would risk increasing, and that were the only thing that were done, it would actually risk exacerbating global instability. And that's why other things of the kind that both Jose Antonio and I agree have to be done. And the reason is very simple. Assume that China revalued. Does that mean the United States is going to start producing apparel or textiles that it was importing from China? No. It will mean it will import it from Bangladesh and Cambodia. That the U.S. trade deficit will probably not change in any significant degree, but it will have there's a law of conservation, and what was a surplus with China will show up in other places, and in particular, those other places will be less willing than China has been to finance the huge U.S. deficits, and that the difficulties of financing the deficit will contribute then to part of the unraveling of the instability, contributed instability in the global system. The second point I want to make is that we have to look more deeply at the what are endogenous versus what are exogenous variables. What are the drivers in the whole system? And in my mind, the most important driver of the system right now is the global reserve system. And that the global reserve system, where people are demanding dollars or have been, as a result of wanting a buffer against the huge instability of the global financial markets, and not wanting the IMF to come in to rescue them, because they saw what happens when the IMF came in to rescue them, so they've accumulated these literally trillions of dollars of reserves, that is one of the forces that are contributing to this global reserve, to these global imbalances. And if that analysis is correct, the solution requires coming up with an alternative global reserve system. The current global reserve system is not only unstable, deflationary, but also inequitable, because it involves developing countries lending to the U.S. at low interest rates and borrowing from the U.S. at high interest rates, an effective form of foreign aid that is greater than all the foreign aid that the United States gives. And then in my book, Making Globalization Work, I describe an alternative an alternative global reserve system that is, I would argue, both more stable, more growth-oriented, and more equitable.